quite a long time on Sunday nights, we've been looking at some kind of series of lessons, favorite chapters of the Bible, some knotty issues that face all of us as Christians. For a few Sunday nights, we're going to look at some rather randomly chosen topics that I hope will be helpful to us in our perspective on the Christian life. Next Sunday night, for example, we're going to have some thoughts about prayer. Tonight, we're going to start with the life of an unusual man, at least unusual in length, in Genesis 5. When Methuselah had lived 187 years, he became the father of Lamech. Methuselah lived after the birth of Lamech 782 years and had other sons and daughters. Then all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. You can just imagine the commercial being over and the master of ceremonies coming out with a big book under his arm, and Methuselah with a look of strange surprise on his face as the master of ceremonies says, "Methuselah, this is your life." And he starts with Methuselah seated in the center of the stage and all the people around just waiting for a parade of persons to come by and tears to begin to flow like they're supposed to in all those presentations, only to have the master of ceremonies open the large book and find a bunch of blank pages with just one sentence. He lived 969 years and he died. For strangely enough, that's the whole commentary the writer of Genesis has on the life of Methuselah. It's an unusual chapter. People have wondered whether time was counted in exactly the same way when people lived so very long before the flood, or they've wondered whether this is the description of the lifespan of a man's family, a whole clan rather than an individual, questions that really one hasn't any tools with which to pursue. But it appears that before the flood, longevity was a mark of life to a much greater extent than it has been since the flood. But in Genesis 5, there is one of those chapters where a genealogy is traced. And it's one of some 10 times in the book of Genesis when the writer says, "And these are the generations of," and begins to tell the generations by which God was sifting out a people. He starts with Adam through Seth, all the way down to Noah, righteous Noah, 10 generations from Adam. And then from Noah through his son Shem down to Abraham, 10 generations removed from Noah. And then from Abraham through Isaac to Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel, and that special people has now been sifted out. There was no hesitation on God's part to bypass an older child for a younger child if character required it. And so Ishmael is set aside and Isaac is chosen. Esau is put aside, Jacob is chosen. Joseph, next to the youngest of 12 sons, is chosen, made the prominent one instead of either of the other of the 12 sons. But with this kind of selection, God is weeding out people, developing people to whom he's going one day to make his covenant known, with whom he'll make the covenant, and to whom he'll give his special revelation. 8 times in this chapter, Genesis 5, the expression is found almost monotonously at the end of paragraphs, "and he died." And yet the chapter has its highlights and its strangeness. The highlight is Enoch. You remember the description of Enoch. He walked with God and he was not, for God took him. That description provoked Hubert Simpson to say in a book about altars of earth that he'd heard a story of a little girl who tried to retell to her Sunday school class what happened to Enoch. She said that Enoch and God were accustomed to taking long walks with one another. And one day they walked very far away from Enoch's home, and God said, "Enoch, you must be tired today. Why don't you come into my house and rest?" And with that, she'd given her description of how Enoch is translated. But it's a long way from Enoch to Methuselah, with that very long lifespan compared with Enoch's. And yet, nothing said about him in a positive way. Just, he lived 969 years, and he died. The tragedy of it all is that there are lots of lives like that. They don't go on quite that long, but they seem to be just that empty. If it weren't for that, I suppose Methuselah would not be worth trying to make a sermon out of. But the tragedy of living a very long time and having nothing to show for it except longevity is still a very possible tragedy today. One can live a shorter time and have the same kind of problem. But it seems to me that Methuselah just being there with that long lifespan and nothing except he lived and he died provokes the question, how does one measure life? What are its dimensions? What's really important in it anyway? I suppose we all have our ways of measuring, and longevity is one of them. few years ago, a lady doctor named Barbara Moore announced her intention to live 300 years. We haven't been able to make that in modern times, but longevity has been increased a great deal. But it would appear that to some people at least, this is the greatest goal in life. Just stretch it out longer. There can be no real question that accumulation of material things is the primary goal to an awful lot of us. It gets intertwined with the other motives of nearly all of us. But it can become an obsession, the way we measure life. What does a man have? I suppose it takes a few people who almost took a cynical view of life to assess it properly. Henry David Thoreau, for example, said there are none of the necessities of life for which money is a requirement. Or George Bernard Shaw looked at wealth and said, there are no rich men, they're just wealthy men. There are no educated men, they're just schooled men. There are no dignified men, they're just well-dressed men. Those may be somewhat cynical comments on life, but they do remind us that we're often prone to measure life by standards that are not too good. And material accumulation is one such standard. The Arabians have a proverb of an Arab who was out in the middle of the desert, tired, hungry, thirsty, and he came upon a little deserted camp. There was a small bag on the ground, and he just dived at it, saying, bread. And when he ran his hand inside and brought it out, it was full of glistening jewels. And he said, just pearls. Because there are times in life when things like that are not of very much value. Measuring life by material things is not a very good standard. No matter how much a man has or how much he wanted it, it takes a very small plot of ground and only one suit for him when the end comes. It's not really allowable for a dead man to occupy a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. Death seems to terminate so many of the ways we measure life, the most important things in life to us as it goes on. If these become first, then life is out of kilter. Longevity, material things, outward appearance, that's a great thing to a lot of us, and I'm sure important to all of us. Remember how God passed by all the sons of Jesse till he got down to David? Hard to convince Samuel that those tall, impressive boys were not the ones God would want to be king, that he really wanted that shepherd lad. But God said to him in 1 Samuel 16:7, do not look on the outward appearance, for the Lord looketh on the heart. He was looking deeper for his friend David, for the man he can trust to lead his people for a long time. But outward appearance would not have been a proper selection criterion. Prestige seems to be an important thing to us as well. What's the man's pedigree? Who was he born to be? What's his family background? And we tend to measure life in those terms. A man may have accomplished nothing else, but he came from the right stock. And then, of course, there's always the last one, reserved for the one you think is worthwhile. It's that sense of purpose and direction a person has in life. The real way to measure life is not the way Methuselah did it, from the indication we have here. Not how long one lives, not the quantity of life, but the quality of life. Not adding years to life, but adding life to years. That's the really important thing, if one can find how to do it. There should have been something to record about Methuselah besides just how many years he lived. Tertullian was a rather brilliant thinker in the church back in the second century, late second century, lived in North Africa, ruddy sort of man. One day he ran across a fellow Christian who was engaged in the business of making idols. And Tertullian condemned him. And he said, but I have to live. And Tertullian said, why? It was his way of saying that something ought to be given as a reason for living other than that. Just that life has to go on. It has to become longer than it is now. There is a standard, and we occasionally have to come back and remind ourselves of what that standard is. Now all of that, and I suppose the length of Methuselah's life, becomes just, again, suggestive of the fact that life has various dimensions. And that we are meant to live in more than one of those dimensions, not to settle simply for one. It was Robert Louis Stevenson who observed that life is so full of a number of things. But everybody knows from living that life can become rather petty. It can settle into a very narrow groove. Your interests can become so small that they really don't stretch very far at all. That's why it's necessary to take the inventory and ask where one is and what he's really living for. highest priorities have gotten arranged because they shift. We want very badly to fit in. There was a time when all of us had Christ first, and we really intended to put His kingdom there, and all the other things we needed would be added. But as one lives, things get rearranged, and almost subtly, imperceptibly, subconsciously, the whole value scale gets altered significantly. If one is going to live properly, he has to live in at least four dimensions. One of those is length. There isn't anything wrong with length of days. In fact, there's one of the Psalms where God makes as a promise that He would give long life. The last verse of Psalm 91, "With long life I will satisfy Him and show Him my salvation." You remember the promise made to children who obey their parents, that it may be well with you, and that you may live long on the earth which the Lord your God gives you. You remember Hezekiah's prayer, and God added 15 years to his life. There's nothing wrong with wanting to live a long time. But length is just one dimension of life. If longevity is treated as a basis by which something else may be accomplished, if it's filled with purpose, there's nothing wrong with longevity. In fact, there are pointers toward the goal of the Christian wanting to live a long time. Our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit. If we dissipate those bodies, tear down their energies, bring destruction on them, that doesn't meet with God's approval. So everybody has a little bit of a desire to live a long time. It's just when longevity becomes the only thing, or the number one thing, that life gets out of balance. That's the tragedy of Methuselah. Just living a long time and having nothing more to say about it. Beside length of life, there has to be breadth. Some way to spread open the interests, to bring other people into one's sympathy and concern. Somehow to widen things so that not just oneself or one's immediate family will be involved, but all the good one can do for the whole world in which he lives is involved. Lots of ways to illustrate this. Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan would be primary. E. Stanley Jones, whom I mentioned this morning, he was an early missionary to India, has written several books about his work there. But Jones told the story of an Indian hunter who went out into the woods on a foggy day to do his hunting, and he saw what appeared to be a monster coming toward him. And he raised his gun, took aim, and just as he aimed down the barrel, he recognized that it was a human form and not a monster after all. And then as he eased his hand away from the trigger and the person approached a little closer, he noticed that it was his brother. And from that, Jones drew a parallel. As long as we look at other people through a fog and we don't really know them, everybody has the experience. You drop into a strange group. They look like monsters, unfriendly persons, until one begins to draw closer to them. And that goes away. And there opens up the possibility, at least, of a brotherly relationship. Billy Rose told a story that you've probably heard. These incidents, for the most part, are well-known ones. But it was the story of a boy in World War II who was injured in a naval battle and wasn't heard of for some time. But he survived. And one night from San Diego, he called his startled parents. And they were thrilled to know he was alive. And he said, "I want to come home, but I want to bring with me a buddy who's had a very tough time of it. He's been in a battle. He was hurt. He's lost an eye, lost a leg, lost an arm. He doesn't have any place to go. I'd like to bring him home with me." The parents were thrilled that he was coming home, but they let him know in a hurry they really didn't want his buddy. That kind of person would be a handicap on the family. It would hold them back. He would take an awful lot of time. It would just be better if he not get involved. A couple of days later, by Billy Rose's story, the adjutant general called, telegrammed the family, and told them their son had jumped out a hotel window the night before and was dead. When the body arrived home, you guessed it, it had one leg, one eye, and one arm. He was convinced that nobody really cared enough to be willing to take the time for him. And so life wasn't worth going on. A breadth of concern that he wanted to spread even more wider than just himself, beyond family. And when it wasn't that broad, he was afraid it wouldn't be broad enough to include himself. Life has to have length, and it has to have breadth. And life has to have depth. Remember Paul's writing in Ephesians 3 about the Christians coming to know the love of Christ, which passes knowledge, that they might know its height, its breadth, its length, and its depth. All those four dimensions. Depth. If you're just going to build an ordinary house, you may just scrape off the top of the ground, pour a slab, and build it. But if you're going to put up a skyscraper, you better put those posts down pretty deep. Something's going to have to support it beyond just a surface support. I've wondered why Manhattan is the tallest city in the world. But I'm told the reason is, basically, that it's built on solid rock. The island is solid rock. Tokyo, for example, can't have those tall skyscrapers. Honshu Island is made out of sand. People who build in Florida face the same kind of problem. And life is like that. If life only has a very shallow lake nature about it, it stagnates no matter how wide it is. Breadth or length will not be enough. The lake has to have some depth. The inflow of vital streams keeping it alive. And so must human life have that dimension. Something to give it some real depth. Some real convictions to go down to. Or else it isn't going to be full. And life has to have one other dimension, and that's height. Something to reach up toward. Some hope beyond itself. The Imeses aren't here tonight. They've been amazing to me for nearly 7 years now, and I'm sure they have been to many of you longer than that. But I've tried to pull for some of the keys for what keeps them so vital in mid-80s. And what they tell me each time is, I'm looking forward to what we're going to do in a couple of weeks. They always have a goal ahead. There's something they haven't achieved yet. They're fresh and ready to meet that new goal. There always has to be something higher than we are now that we're reaching up to, some goal we want to accomplish. One of the horrible punishments that was meted out in the medieval period to criminals, or people who were thought to be criminals, was putting them into dungeons that were not tall enough for them to stand erect in. I think being incarcerated in a place like that for a period of time would be about as cruel as anything that could happen. Just never being able to stand erect. Having no possibility at all for height. Man was made to reach up. He's got to have something to reach toward. Anybody who's ever seen a mountain wants to see it again. He wants to go back to the place where the peaks go very high and the air gets thin and the world is more beautiful because he can see so much of it with an amazing perspective. That's the thing that makes the life of Jesus beautiful. Just 33 years long, but it was so wide, so brief, or so deep, so high. That even though it was so brief, it had the other dimensions to make it worthwhile. Methuselah's, on the other hand, had the one dimension of length and had nothing else about it. I think this is urgent. Maybe it's overly simple, but it's urgent because most of you are going to live a very long time. Compared with people before ourselves, our lives are going to be quite long. In 1855, the average life expectancy in America was 40 years. Today, it's better than 70. In fact, out of every 100,000 Americans, 88,361 will live to be 50 years old. Have you looked through an old family Bible or an old church record book lately? When you do, you'll be amazed to see the number of people who died in their mid-30s. That seems to be the rule, not the exception. But more than 88,000 out of every 100,000 will live to be 50. Accidental death will take much of the rest of the toll. 70,000 people out of every 100,000 Americans are expected to reach the age of 70. That's an amazing percentage. There are between 10 and 15 million people in America today over 70 years old. When 70,000 out of every 100,000 are expected to live to 70 or past, when 17,000 out of every 100,000 are expected to reach 85 or more, life is going to go on quite a while. And to have to face that period in life when retirement gets earlier and earlier, often enforced because young people are waiting for the jobs with more vitality, perhaps better training, great goals, it gets difficult to look forward to that period and to know how one's going to fill it. Just rocking isn't going to be enough. And lots of people are learning that already. It's having some other dimension in life besides length that makes life count in a time like that. It has to have some breadth of sympathy and love and concern for other people, some depth of conviction, some height of hope and longing, if life is to be meaningful. Who'd want to live without a reason beyond just living longer? But it isn't just the older person. You know the saws of our time about being over 30. But something does happen to all of us as we get a little older. Dorothy Parker has described this as life becoming a crazy plaid of good and bad, by which she was saying that the good kind of gets mixed with the bad, and it's harder to tell them apart than it once was. A very young person with high ideals knows exactly the direction he or she wants to take and is extremely critical of anything apart from that. But as one gets older, he tends to settle for a little less. There may be doubtful things that he's willing to engage in now because he has to live, and he forgets Tertullian's question, why? And as we begin to settle for less, life takes on less and less meaning. And it can happen a lot earlier than the older people I talked about a moment ago. I suppose that's one thing that makes a person so happy to be engaged in church work. There are lots of reasons not to be, perhaps. But I've never been able to think of those for very long at a time. There are so many reasons to be. Because it's so near the center of what life is about. Because one has the feeling he may be helping one or two other people, at least, find the other dimensions of life. But there is church work within the reach of everybody. It's easy to become a congregation of listeners, to go away and forget what manner of man we were when we looked in the mirror, to fail to carry out that dimension of life. I've never been one to try to organize people in a great fashion so that we're sure that all seven of your nights are covered every week and you have a duty to perform on each one of them. Because I have the feeling that you have some duties at home that are as great as any we could send you on somewhere else or greater. But at the same time, in that home where you are, on that job where you are, supplemented by that person in the hospital you can help, and that older person you can comfort, and that needy person you can share with, life can become full and meaningful. It isn't just busy work. Hyper-organization can have us feeling that everything is just bumping and bouncing. But the boiler has to have some connection with the engine, and enthusiasm alone won't do it. There has to be a purpose, a reason. But on the other hand, life can't get tied up with just one or two dimensions. It isn't just to be long. It has to have breadth and depth and height. That's the secret of Paul. I'm crucified with Christ, but I live. Not I. Christ lives in me. The life I live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. It's a dimension not discoverable anywhere else. And it's something you and I almost take for granted because we've known it so long. The real happiness goes from the heart because we've known so long where meaning was. But life can become empty again, shallow, if we're not regularly in pursuit of all the dimensions. Methuselah, a tragedy. He lived that long and then just died. Nothing else to be said. I doubt whether you or I will ever make the program, "This Is Your Life." But I can't help wondering, when somebody looks through the life, what they're going to find. And that might be determined for someone tonight while we sing.
Search me and try me, Master, today, whiter than snow, Lord, wash me just now, as in thy presence humbly I bow. Have thine own way, Lord, have thine own way. Wounded and weary, help me, I pray. Power, all power, surely is thine. Touch me and heal me, Savior divine. Have thy